Garment couldn't get the arguments out fast enough. The president might have the technical power, but he didn't have enough political strength to exercise it for old friends and aides. The president had to go out of office in presidential fashion. Imagine, Garment said, Nixon's last act being pardons for all his old cronies. That would ensure that Watergate could never be put into perspective. Haig said that the president felt that pardons would allow him to assume the entire burden of Watergate. He felt responsible for the plight of his old friends. All the guilt and responsibility and the public outrage falling on Nixon. Garment knew how that would appeal to him. They just couldn't let him do it, Garment told Haig. But as Haig got up and went across the hall to the washroom, Garment worried that he hadn't mustered all his arguments. Buzzard and then St. Clair returned. Haig and Garment met them in Buzzard's office. Buzzard was also opposed. He had already taken steps to block any pardon requests that might come through the Justice Department, the normal route. Haig told them that he had been negative on the subject with the president and that he was supposed to be checking with the lawyers. Haldeman was really pushing and had tried to get through directly to the president, but Haig had intercepted the call. He was afraid that Haldeman would find a way to get through to Nixon. Haig's conversion now seemed complete. That criminal has asked for a pardon, he said. He expressed disbelief. The arrogance was incredible. It was blackmail. It had to be stopped. Buzzard calmly offered to call Haldeman's chief attorney, John Wilson, and explain that pardons would be impossible. Well, said St. Clair at last, maybe pardons should be considered. It was worthwhile to explore the possibility before leaping to conclusions. Haig and Garment pounced on him. If the president grants this pardon, Garment said, he will be ensuring his own trial. He will be forcing it. The public has to have a head, and if the president takes the heads away, the public will have his. And that would be the monkey trial of all time. The president has to take his chances. St. Clair was soon persuaded that they should urge the president to reject the request. Haig had word that David Eisenhower and Ed Cox wanted to see him. He called Buchanan and asked him to go talk to the president's sons-in-law. Although there were signs that the family was relenting, Haig said, they were still the last stumbling block to resignation. Bruce Hershenson, Haig said, was talking to Julie, reinforcing her opinion that her father should never resign. Hershenson wanted the president to go down in history as a fighter, and he was telling her that winning or losing in the Senate was not the important thing, that standing up for the office would assure the president his proper role in history. Buchanan said he would be glad to take on the task. David and Ed arrived in Buchanan's office shortly afterward. "We've come to see you about the president," Cox said. They were trying to get both sides, and they wanted to hear the arguments in favor of resignation again. For an hour, Buchanan calmly plowed back through the ground covered Saturday, insisting still that resignation was the only solution. David was impressed that Buchanan, the ultimate Nixon man, had overcome his conditioning. He had the character to arrive at his own conclusion and hold it in the face of the president's resistance. This gave David confidence that he too would be able to hold his ground against his wife and his father-in-law. Cox did most of the talking and questioning. He weighed both sides carefully, as if he were going to make a presentation, and wanted to be able to state each side of the case fully and fairly. David and Ed thanked Buchanan. Then they picked up Tricia and walked over to the president's EOB office. Because the discussion was to be a lawyerly review, Tricia did not go inside. The president was sitting alone. David was glad they were in the EOB office. He felt that this room, unlike the Oval Office with its ceremonial trappings, invited conversation on a human scale. David divided conversations with his father-in-law into two categories. Either Nixon dominated and did most of the talking, or he was withdrawn and allowed conversations to simply go on around him. This time, it was different. They had information to exchange. Ed explained that he and David had been canvassing people to get recommendations. There were arguments for and against staying. If he stayed and didn't resign, Cox said, the administration still had vast resources to make a defense in a Senate trial. It would be heroic, and a vigorous defense might narrow the charges. Whatever the result, the full airing would lend perspective to Watergate and show that it was a small matter. Borrowing from Buchanan, David and Ed then outlined the arguments for resignation. A Senate trial could take months, disrupt the government, hurt the economy, and complicate foreign relations. The country needed a leader, David said. The president shot a glance at him. David thought he might have gone too far, but the president seemed, for once, willing to discuss Watergate matter-of-factly.
"Unless something happens," Nixon said, "my friends in the Senate are saying I should resign."
He looked away from David and Ed. Those friends included Senators Stennis, Long, Bennett, and James B. Allen of Alabama, Nixon said.
"I haven't decided anything for sure," he said abruptly, but David sensed that he had.
The president was calm about the subject, one of the few times David had seen him so. He was dealing rationally with arguments on both sides. His visitors nodded understandingly. They were not pushing.
"Do you think they're going to give us a hard time on our papers and tapes?" Nixon asked.
That, too, seemed to indicate he was planning to leave office, David thought. They both said he should certainly be entitled to keep his papers, tapes, and files, as other presidents had. Nixon took another step. He wondered about transporting his files to California. If he resigned, that was where he would go. He wanted to own the papers so that he could work on his book. He would write his memoirs. If he didn't get his papers, people would be rummaging through them for years. The president posed other questions about his future. It was a future out of office, in California.
"I want to take some time off to travel."
That would be a good idea.
"What about the climate of retribution?"
he asked. He answered his own question. Slowly.
If he resigned, people would become apathetic about him. And, of course, resignation would silence him politically for a long time.
David knew that the great unspoken item of business was a pardon for his father-in-law. But the president didn't broach it. Nixon seemed to lose interest in the conversation. Normally, he would have dismissed his visitors at that point. But Nixon seemed to cling to them, letting the talk wander back and forth. Clearly, he didn't want them to leave, so they stayed. David thought it was as if Mr. Nixon didn't have anything to do. Finally, the president picked up the phone and called Steve Bull.
"When the fellows come in, put them in the office, and I'll be over in a few minutes."
David and Ed left. Bull didn't make it to the Oval Office with the president's visitors, Scott, Goldwater, and Rhodes. As they came in at the West Wing basement, Timmons had them intercepted and brought to his office. Haig, Birch, and Timmons once again reviewed the necessity of keeping the meeting cool.
"He's been up and down," Haig said. "It's about 90% set with him now. Please, don't raise the question of resignation. He knows what you're going to tell him about the situation. He needs to hear it from you."
"He'll get the truth," Goldwater said.
"That's what he wants?"
Goldwater was disbelieving. Nixon rarely wanted that.
"Yes,"
Haig said. Haig meant to turn the meeting into a ritual in which the senators could imagine they were asserting their authority and the president could preserve the illusion that he was acting independently. The three leaders left Timmons' office and walked down the hall and into the Oval Office. It was about 5 p.m. The president entered seconds later. He shook hands with all three.
"How's that boy of yours?" he asked Rhodes.
"He's fine," the minority leader answered, astounded. But Nixon always remembered personal details. "He's working in the trust department of the Valley National Bank," Rhodes said.
"That's great," the president said. "That's a great bank."
The president turned and sat down behind the large desk. Rhodes took the chair to the president's left, Scott the one to the right. Goldwater was directly in front. Scott realized it was probably the first time he had talked to the president without one of the White House aides in attendance. He had had private conversations with Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, but never with Nixon. The president seemed at ease, almost serene, as he leaned back in his swivel chair and began chatting. Goldwater thought he looked as though he had just shot a hole in one. Disappointment was audible in his voice, however. The president referred briefly to men he had campaigned for, who had turned against him. He knew their names. Rhodes was thinking that there was no sense of wrongdoing in the president's attitude. Nixon was talking politics and votes as if it were another bill on which he wanted a head count. Then abruptly, Nixon cut the small talk. "Well, we are all aware of why you are here. We might as well get down to it." He turned to Rhodes. "I guess I've got maybe 10 votes on the floor of the House?" he asked, with a faint hint of sarcasm. Before Rhodes could answer, he was going to say that the president had more, maybe 50 or 60. Nixon turned to the others. "Who wants to open up?"
"We've asked Barry to be our spokesman," Scott replied.
"Go ahead, Barry," the president said, staring straight ahead at Goldwater. "Mr. President, this isn't pleasant, but you want to know the situation, and it isn't good."
Goldwater was certain the president had heard his estimate on the phone to Haig the day before, but lots of numbers had been flying around for several days. 12, 15, less than 20. Goldwater was thinking, what had he told Haig?
"Pretty bad, huh?"
"Yes, sir," Goldwater answered, still trying to recall the exact number he had quoted.
"How many would you say would be with me?" "A half dozen?" the president asked. Was that sarcasm in his voice?
"More than that," Goldwater said. "Maybe 16 to 18.
"Hugh," the president said, turning to his right, "do you agree with that?"
"I'd say maybe 15, Scott said. "But it's grim," he added, "and they're not very firm."
"Damn grim," the president shot back.
Goldwater said, "We've discussed the thing a lot, and just about all of the guys have spoken up, and there aren't many who would support you if it comes to that."
Goldwater decided to ram it home.
"I took kind of a nose count today, and I couldn't find more than 4 very firm votes, and those would be from older Southerners. Some are very worried about what's been going on and are undecided, and I'm one of them."
That final kick had delivered, Goldwater hoped. The president turned to Rhodes.
"John, I know how you feel, what you've said, and I respect it, but what's your estimate?"
Rhodes was thinking there would still be some support for the president in the House, but he wanted the message to be stern.
"About the same, Mr. President," he said. "Well, that's about the way I thought it was. I've got a very difficult decision to make, but I want you to know I'm going to make it for the best interests of the country."
There were nods around 3 sides of the desk.
"I'm not interested in pensions," the president continued. "I'm not interested in pardons or amnesty. I'm going to make this decision for the best interests of the country."
Goldwater could feel tears in his eyes. He could see that the others were emotional, too.
"Mr. President," Scott said, "we are all very saddened, but we have to tell you the facts."
"Never mind," the president replied, almost jerking out the words, watching the eyes of his visitors. "There'll be no tears. I haven't cried since Eisenhower died. My family has been fine. I'm going to be all right."
He talked about how much he had loved President Eisenhower. It had been a long time in politics, the president said. Goldwater and he had been campaigning for about 20 years. He started to muse again about things he had done for some of the people who now wanted him out of office, then stopped himself short.
"But this is water over the dam," he said. "It's beside the point."
He leaned toward Rhodes.
"Do I have any other options?"
"Mr. President," Rhodes answered, "when I leave this room, I want to tell the people who are waiting outside that we never discussed any options."
"Oh, I do too," the president said hastily. "I didn't mean that." He paused. "I'm going to make the decision," he said flatly.
All the points in the script had been covered.
The president stood up from behind his desk.
Well, thank you very much, he said.
Thank you, Rhodes replied. You're a great friend. The president didn't reply. He shook their hands, but he seemed locked in thought as they walked out. Haig and Birch were waiting for the three leaders in Timmons' office. Goldwater summarized the session. Haig wanted to be certain. Did the president make any statement beyond what you've said? He asked intently.
No.
No. No. There had been no slip-ups, no demands, no deals for resignation. Goldwater said that they were going to meet with reporters but would not get into any details. Haig assented. As they walked out of Timmons' office, Goldwater asked Rhodes, Is there any doubt in your mind what he's going to do?
No.
Any doubt in yours?
No. It's sort of amazing. Here's the first time this has ever happened. And who was sitting there with the president? Two guys from one of the smallest states.
The meeting had not taken long. It was 5:42 when they walked to the cameras.
Whatever decision he makes, it will be in the best interest of our country, Goldwater said.
There has been no decision made, the reporters pressed. Goldwater lied. I have no way of knowing, and we have no way of making nose counts, he said. I myself have not made up my mind, and I think I can speak for most of the senators that they haven't made up their minds.
Scott backed him up.
We have not discussed or taken any counts ourselves, as far as I know. While the congressional leaders were with the president, Haig had called Buzzard, St. Clair, and Garment into his office. He wanted them all there as witnesses in case any improper suggestions were made. Then he phoned Haldeman. St. Clair listened to the conversation on an extension.
Bob, the matter has been seriously considered, Haig said. It just can't be done. We've talked about it here thoroughly.
Haldeman asked for an opportunity to put his request and his thoughts in writing. It was already being worked on, he said.
Sure, make the presentation, Haig said,
glad for another opportunity to stall. Goldwater drove back to the Senate with Scott and spent more than an hour on the phone with Arizona reporters. Content that resignation was set, he then escorted his daughter-in-law to a dinner at the Iranian embassy. Senator Scott returned to his office and gave his staff the president's schedule for the next 2 days, which Timmons had given him. Scott warned that it was not to leak to the press. Thursday, 5:30 p.m. President meets with the bipartisan congressional leadership. 6:30 p.m. President meets with his old congressional friends. 9 p.m. Television address to the nation announcing resignation. Friday, noon. Resignation effective and Ford sworn in. Small ceremony in Oval Office. Haig stayed in his office, trying to keep the story of the president's expected resignation under wraps. For one thing, the president could change his mind. For another, there must be no interregnum. The transition, when it came, had to be quick and smooth. But Nixon was still president, and he had to be in a strong enough position to handle a crisis. Haig had to sustain the appearance that the president was still active and in charge. There were lies that had to be told to staff, to friends, to the press. Bill Baruti had scheduled a meeting of 23 housing and construction leaders in the cabinet room for the following day. Haig didn't tell him the president couldn't make it. The tea leaf readers all over the White House were looking for clues. The secretarial group in the counsel's office heard that Steve Bull was at the Exchange, a local bar, drinking one scotch after the other. They took that as an indication that it was all over. Actually, Bull didn't know what was happening either. He was at another bar, the class reunion, arguing with a friend that resignation was ill-advised. Haig was confident that the lid was on tight. Rosemary Woods was circulating among staff members in the East Wing, saying that the president would not resign. It was common knowledge that more than one speech was in the works. At lunch that afternoon in the White House mess, Price had lied flatly to his chief assistant, Gergen, and to Ann Morgan. He was not working on a resignation speech. Gergen and Morgan were unconvinced. After lunch, Gergen went back to his office and began an eyes-only memo to Price. Overall, Ray, Gergen typed on his electric typewriter, I'm suggesting a brief, dignified, generous, almost upbeat speech. It's absolutely essential that he be neither vindictive nor mawkish. This could be one of his shining hours, and the way he departs will have a tremendous impact on the country's future. By the time Price read the memo, he already had a draft of a resignation speech. The president had to resign, but there was nothing upbeat about the moment to Price, and there never could be. Then Ben Stein came around with his non-resignation speech, in which the president was contrite, admitted his complicity, and talked about the country's great people and their capacity for forgiveness. Nixon would never give it, Price said. He'll never say, "I'm sorry." The press was searching frantically for information. Terry Ivey had confirmed to UPI correspondent Helen Thomas that Ed and Tricia Cox had arrived from New York. The story went over the wire, and Manolo Sanchez angrily called Ivey to complain, saying that nothing was to be given to the press. Ivey argued back to one of Julie's best friends on the staff, Patricia Mattson, that it was foolish not to answer routine press inquiries. Refusing to answer only bred more rumors and heightened the tension. "Remember who you work for," Mattson shouted at Ivey. "These people's hearts are breaking. How can you want to help the press? You've got to figure out your priorities." Ivey refused all press calls for the rest of the day. The commotion and the incessant search for the slightest detail were getting on the nerves of the press office staff. Finally, Ziegler couldn't handle it any longer. He summoned Warren. "God damn it, Jerry, cool them off!" There was no way. The confusion was shared by the group that Buchanan Whitted assembled at White's house around 5 p.m. Ford wouldn't let anyone contact the Secret Service to obtain more office space for the transition effort. The vice president had told the New York Times that neither he nor his staff had made any plans. Earlier that day, at a regular weekly prayer meeting with Rhodes and Laird, Ford had shunned any discussion of his possible succession. But he had quietly directed his top aide, Robert Hartman, to draft a speech, just in case. Buchan and Whitted took the precaution of going to White's house in separate cars. Former Congressman Burns was already there. Griffin and Bryce Harlow arrived soon after. White's son, Roger, was assigned to monitor the television set and answer the phone. Peggy White cooked some steaks. As the group worked on an 11-item agenda prepared by Whitted and Buchan, a call came for Griffin. The senator stepped out of the living room and picked up the phone. It was Ed Cox. Cox said he wasn't at all sure the president was going to resign. David and he had just met with Nixon and had received no assurances. There were hints, but nothing firm. The president had talked about being out of office and going back to California. It seemed to Cox that he was thinking about being impeached and convicted. That would take months. More alarming, Cox said, his mother-in-law had told him, "Dick is not talking about resigning." Griffin tried to calm Cox down. He again sounded distraught and mixed up. Cox told him once more that the family was deeply worried about the president's mental condition, the lack of sleep, the pressure. As Griffin rejoined the group, he was confused. He told the others that apparently the president was not talking about resigning. Buchan was overwhelmed. They were moving on something that might not happen in a week or a year. This meeting might be a great personal embarrassment to them all, and most of all to the vice president. It could be made to look like a beer hall putsch. Griffin went over his conversation with Cox. The uncertainty was terrible. Could it be a hoax? Or a setup? Several asked. Buchan comforted himself that the vice president would not proceed unless he was positive. Ford always played on the side of caution. Anyway, it was more sensible to deal with the logistics of transition than with the possibility that Nixon would not resign. The president could only delay his departure. He could no longer avoid it. "We can't sit here and speculate whether it will happen or not," Buchan finally said. "We have to assume it will and proceed." He had a copy of the agenda in his hand, and he read the first item. Assumption of office. The swearing-in. Griffin was concerned about the tone of the swearing-in. It must be low-key, before a small audience. To hold the ceremony in the Oval Office might seem presumptuous. It was not Ford's office until he took the oath. There was disagreement on whether Nixon should be invited or whether Ford should mention Nixon in his remarks afterward. Burns said it was essential to avoid the kind of ceremony that took place when Ford was nominated to replace Agnew, the tasteless strolling strings and the pomp suggesting an occasion of national pride. Griffin urged that Nixon's staff be cleared out of the White House as soon as possible. It was assumed that the staff and the cabinet would resign. Everyone agreed that full disengagement from the Nixon White House was essential. But it would not happen overnight. Ford would have to meet with the White House staff at once and solicit their help in the transition.
"The number one priority is to get rid of Ziegler," Buchan said.
OMB Director Ash and his deputy Malik had to go immediately, others suggested. They were Nixon symbols. Buchan recognized that everyone was expressing his particular frustrations. Griffin wanted Congress to play more of a role.
"We can't decide that now," Buchan said.
Working his way down the list, he focused on smaller problems. Should Ford attend church the first Sunday of his administration? About 9 o'clock, as they sat down to dinner, Scranton arrived. They went on until midnight. When the meeting broke up, Buchan thanked White's wife.
"You might lose your dining room table to the Smithsonian someday," he told her.
The president stayed a while in the Oval Office after his meeting with Goldwater, Scott, and Rhodes. Then he had his picture taken in the Rose Garden, and then went to the solarium. The family had gathered there. Rosemary Woods had come in a few minutes before his arrival.
"Your father has decided to resign," she said, looking at the president's two daughters.
David had been telling Julie for days it would all be over soon. Now she heard it, stunned, relieved, and consumed with sadness and a sense of unfairness. The president stepped into the room.
"We're going back to California," he said,
and indicated that there would be no discussion. His daughters broke down. Mrs. Nixon did not cry. There was a knock on the door, and photographer Ollie Atkins came in. Ziegler had instructed him that morning to photograph absolutely everything.
"Ollie," Mrs. Nixon said, "we're always glad to see you, but I don't think we need any pictures now."
"Oh, come on, Ollie," the president said. "Take a few shots."
The president directed everyone to stand between a bookcase and the yellow print drapes. He was wearing a coat and tie. His wife and daughters had on print dresses. Ed wore a tie, but his coat was off. David was tieless, his sleeves rolled up. The daughters were weeping, and Atkins had to take shot after shot to get a picture with everyone smiling. The family stood in a line, their arms about each other or holding hands. Atkins finally thought he had some shots with no one crying. But as he backed out the doorway, still snapping, Julie and the president fell weeping into each other's arms. Standing next to them, Tricia broke down, her face contorted, arms dangling. The weight lifted only slightly during dinner. The president talked about life in California. He hoped the girls and their husbands would be able to visit often. Dinner lasted about 45 minutes. Then the president left, saying he was going down to work on his speech. At 7 p.m., he was in the Oval Office. He had a message from Haig. The general was waiting in his office with the lawyers when the president telephoned back. Haldeman had been told that pardons could not be granted, Haig reported. The president seemed to indicate that he had overcome the biggest barrier, his family. They had been informed. They didn't like the decision, the president said, but he could handle them. Nixon asked Haig if he had lingering doubts.
"It is absolutely the right course," Haig replied.
The president left the Oval Office at about 8 o'clock and went upstairs to the Lincoln sitting room in the southeast corner of the mansion. It was his favorite room, the smallest in the White House, only about 16 by 13 feet, designed and arranged for one person. All the furniture, Victorian chairs, a deep, low couch with high sleigh arms, was uncomfortable, except for Nixon's overstuffed brown leather chair and ottoman in the corner. The room was his retreat. He had his music, a stereo, and 2 5-foot shelves of records were within reach. 19th-century prints were arranged over the gray marble fireplace. One was of President Lincoln's last reception. There was another of Lincoln and his son, another of Lincoln and his wife, and still another of Lincoln and his family. Now Nixon summoned Kissinger. Kissinger was expecting resignation and had had his assistants, Eagleburger and Scowcroft, devise a 14-step plan to deal with the transition. It included a statement by Ford at the time of swearing in concerning the continuity of foreign policy, specific presidential messages to 37 countries, and calls by Kissinger himself to 14 key ambassadors. For the first time in 5.5 years, Kissinger would not be reviewing his plans with Nixon. He was, in fact, supremely relieved that Nixon was finally going. For months, the Secretary of State had been worrying that the world might blow up. But as he walked over and took the elevator to the second floor, he was also angry. Watergate had wrecked his foreign affairs strategy. The domestic impact was tiny compared to the repercussions abroad. If someone had suggested 10 years before to Harvard professor Henry Kissinger that a superpower could be paralyzed in the nuclear age by a domestic scandal, he would have answered, never. Preposterous. He walked into the alcove. There was the president in his chair, as he had seen him so often. Kissinger really didn't like the president. Nixon had made him the most admired man in the country. Yet the secretary couldn't bring himself to feel affection for his patron. They sat for a time and reminisced about events, travels, shared decisions. The president was drinking. He said he was resigning. It would be better for everyone. They talked quietly. History, the resignation decision, foreign affairs. Then Nixon said that he wasn't sure he would be able to resign. Could he be the first president to quit office? Kissinger responded by listing the president's contributions, especially in diplomacy. "Will history treat me more kindly than my contemporaries?" Nixon asked, tears flooding to his eyes. "Certainly, definitely," Kissinger said. When this was all over, the president would be remembered for the peace he had achieved. The president broke down and sobbed. Kissinger didn't know what to do. He felt cast in a fatherly role. He talked on. He picked up on the themes he had heard so many times from the president. He remembered lines about enemies, the need to stand up to adversity, to face criticism forthrightly. Between sobs, Nixon was plaintive. What had he done to the country and its people? He needed some explanation. How had it come to this? How had a simple burglary, a breaking and entering, done all this? Kissinger kept talking, trying to turn the conversation back to all the good things, all the accomplishments. Nixon wouldn't hear of it. He was hysterical. "Henry," he said, "you are not a very Orthodox Jew, and I am not an Orthodox Quaker, but we need to pray." Nixon got down on his knees. Kissinger felt he had no alternative but to kneel down too. The president prayed out loud, asking for help, rest, peace, and love. How could a president and a country be torn apart by such small things? Kissinger thought he had finished, but the president did not rise. He was weeping. And then, still sobbing, Nixon leaned over and struck his fist on the carpet, crying, "What have I done? What has happened?" Kissinger touched the president and then held him, tried to console him, to bring rest and peace to the man who was curled on the carpet like a child. The President of the United States. Kissinger tried again to reassure him, reciting Nixon's accomplishments. Finally, the president struggled to his feet. He sat back down in his chair. The storm had passed. He had another drink. Kissinger lingered, He talked on, building a case, pouring his academic talents into a lecture on why Richard Nixon would go down in history as one of the great peacemakers of all time.
"You made the tough decisions," he said.
The two men had another drink. Their conversation drifted around to personalities and to the role Nixon might be able to play once he was out of office. He might be an advisor or a special ambassador. Nixon wondered again if he would be exonerated by history. Kissinger was encouraging. He was willing to say anything. But he was certain that Nixon would never escape the verdict of Watergate. At last, Kissinger got up to leave. Nixon had never really asked as much of him as he had that night. Vietnam, Cambodia, Russia, China, they all seemed easier. Weak in the knees, his clothes damp from perspiration, Kissinger escaped. Though he was the president's only top advisor to survive Watergate, he had never really been consulted about resignation. As he walked through the West Wing corridor to his office, Kissinger thought he had never felt as close to or as far from Richard Nixon. Never as close to or as far from anyone he had ever known. Eagleburger and Scowcroft were waiting. It was almost 11. Kissinger looked somber and drained. He did not shout orders, ask for messages, make phone calls, or demand reports. He was clearly upset. To get control over his own tensions, Kissinger began talking about the encounter. The president was definitely resigning, he said.
"It was the most wrenching thing I have ever gone through in my life. Hand-holding,"
Kissinger added. The president was a broken man. What a traumatic experience it had been. What a profound shock to see a man at the end of his rope. He was convinced that historians would at least treat Nixon better than his contemporaries had, but it might take some time before that particular revisionist history could be written. Scowcroft mentioned that he thought it significant that the president had turned to Kissinger for sustenance in his most awful moment. Not to Haig, not to any of the others.
"Henry," Eagleburger said, "at times I've thought you're not human. But I was wrong. I've never seen you so moved."
The phone rang. It was the president. Eagleburger picked up an extension to listen. That was the custom. Kissinger rarely took a call alone. Eagleburger was shocked. The president was slurring his words. He was drunk. He was out of control.
"It was good of you to come up and talk, Henry," the president said. "I've made the decision, but you must stay. You must stay on for the good of the country."
Eagleburger could barely make out what the president was saying. He was almost incoherent. It was pathetic. Eagleburger felt ill and hung up. The president had one last request.
"Henry, please don't ever tell anyone that I cried and that I was not strong."
While the president was talking to Kissinger, Mrs. Nixon was making plans to leave. She called Chief Usher Rex Scouten and told him that the president had decided to resign and that the family would be going to California on Friday. That didn't leave much time. She asked Scouten to make sure the packing was completed by then. He was to do whatever was required, bring in extra help, and make sure there were enough boxes and cartons. David and Julie went back to their apartment at the Columbia Plaza. Julie called some old friends on the staff, including Lieutenant Colonel Brennan. The White House switchboard phoned to say that John Ehrlichman was on the line. She told David,
"I'll get on the extension," he said. "Don't make any promises."
He knew about Haldeman's pardon request, and he wanted Julie to stay clear of such matters. Ehrlichman bantered briefly.
"You know," he finally said, "I was thinking one solution to the problems would be pardons. It would save a lot of embarrassment to the president."
Julie put him off politely. David was infuriated. It was blackmail. How appropriate, he thought, that it came from the man Hunt had been blackmailing in the Watergate cover-up. Ehrlichman sounded like Hunt. No wonder the president had gotten into so much trouble. David took a call from Buchanan. Buchanan remained convinced that the president had to resign, but some questions could be raised about the timing. As David listened, he was thinking that the pressure was unbearable, that neither the president nor Julie could take any more. He hoped Buchanan wasn't shifting ground. "Let the death watch go away first," Buchanan advised. "Wait a few days so that the president could leave office more under his own control. Why hurry him?" David said he'd exchange a little dignity for a little relief. At midnight, the president was still working on his resignation speech. He phoned Ziegler twice before 2 a.m. and again at 3:58. Between 4:15 and 5:07, the president talked with Price four times to offer suggestions and additions to the speech. His last call to Ziegler was at 5:14 in the morning. Thursday, August 8th. Haig was at his office before 8, figuring out how to get the president through the day and to the resignation speech at 9 that night. Today, Haig would have to sound out Jaworski. Clearly, it was the intention of the Watergate grand jury to prosecute Nixon, but ultimately the decision would be Jaworski's. Haig felt strongly that Nixon should not be prosecuted, that neither the country nor the president could bear it. Nixon was pathetic, a victim of a tragedy, Haig sometimes said. He knew Nixon was frightened about what lay in store for him, even though the president rarely mentioned it. Haig wanted badly to help, to bring home some guarantee against prosecution. It would be a fine thing to do, the right thing, for Nixon and for the family. There was also the matter of pardons. Haig had to make Jaworski aware that Haldeman and Ehrlichman had made demands, and damn fast before he heard it from someone else. That could make them all look bad. It might look as if the White House was once again plotting. Haig was uneasy that the matter had even been discussed. Had he compromised himself already? The White House lawyers said no, but Haig thought he had always gotten better legal advice from Jaworski than from anyone else. Haig wanted to be as open and above board with Jaworski as possible, to notify him of the resignation in advance and lay out the whole picture. He wanted to convey his feelings and get some kind of reading on how Prosecutor Jaworski intended to deal with Citizen Nixon. Haig had already scheduled a tentative meeting with the prosecutor, but it couldn't take place at the White House or at Jaworski's office. If word got out that the two were meeting, there would be cries of plea bargaining. Haig got back to Jaworski. "You can't come over here," he said. "Every single entrance is covered by the press." He suggested they meet at his home, a stone house the general rented, in the wooded Wellesley Heights section of Northwest Washington. The meeting was set for 11:30. The president was up by 8:30, after 3 hours of sleep. He had his regular breakfast, cold cereal, orange juice, and milk, and just after 9, he walked from the residence through the Rose Garden to the Oval Office. He took no phone calls. Even a call from Billy Graham was taken by Woods. 2 minutes after the president arrived in the office, Haig presented himself. Nixon told him he wanted to see Vice President Ford and that he would spend the rest of the day working on his speech. After Haig left, the president spent 20 minutes alone, and then Ziegler came to get permission to call the television networks and reserve airtime. Ziegler returned to his office and called CBS. Then he took a file from his drawer and opened to the first page. Fifth draft, August 8, 1974. Words, 1,835. "This is the blank time I have spoken to you from this office, where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation." Ziegler asked Johnson and Greer to find out the number of Oval Office speeches. Then he sent Warren out to tell the press that there would be a Nixon-Ford meeting. For 2 hours, reporters had been milling around the small briefing room. At 10:55, Warren appeared in his pinstripe suit and blue button-down shirt. He moved through the crowd, acknowledging acquaintances. "How are you?" he asked, smiling. "Haven't seen you in a while." He was so cordial that one reporter thought she was going to be offered a mid-morning drink. "We will be posting some routine information," Warren began. "Bill actions and appointments and nominations, messages to the Congress."
The reporters weren't interested in that kind of news, and they stirred restlessly. The president will be meeting at 11 with Vice President Ford. That started a stampede down the narrow hallway that led to the press cubicles and telephones. "Can we get pictures of Ford and Nixon, Jerry?" a photographer shouted. "No." "There's nothing going on," screamed a reporter from the middle of the crunch. "God, these people are hysterical. It's like a goddamn zoo." In the First Lady's press office in the East Wing, it was quiet. After 3 days of unanswered calls, reporters had given up. St. Clair gathered some of his assistants together. He was still looking for a legal defense on the June 23rd transcripts. Jack McCahill, for one, was astonished. Was St. Clair putting on a good show? Or was he crazy? St. Clair had been informed that Nixon was going to resign, but he still wasn't absolutely convinced it would happen. Watching the president make decisions was like watching sausage being made, he had once observed. When you saw what went into them, you lost your appetite. He no longer believed anything he was told. He'd do his job, stick to the case, and hope to be safe at home in Boston soon. Milton Pitts, the president's barber, was at home at 10 a.m. when Steve Bull called.
"Milt, the president wants to see you about 10:15, Bull said.
Pitts drove to the White House and headed for a small office on the ground floor of the West Wing. He had been serving the president since 1970, when he had gotten a call from Alexander Butterfield. Butterfield and Pitts had met privately in a small back room in Georgetown, and Butterfield had asked Pitts to keep their conversation strictly confidential. He told him the FBI would run a full investigation on him. A week later, Pitts had cut the president's hair for the first time. The second time, Pitts made a suggestion. "I can improve your hair very much by shampooing first, then blending the hair with a razor and using a hot air dryer on it. That will give your hair a softer, more natural look and straighten it some."
The president's steel gray hair was a bit oily and curly and had a shiny look, even though it was healthy and free of dandruff.
The president told Pitts to go ahead. Within 2 weeks, Time magazine had sent a reporter to find out why Nixon's hair looked so much better. The press office said that it was because the president had changed barbers. Pitts felt honored. In the White House that Thursday morning, Pitts prepared the set of tools he used only on the president. Promptly, at 10:15, a Secret Service agent opened the door to the one-chair barber shop, and the president strolled in. The door was shut. Nixon and his barber were alone. As the president approached the chair, he flashed a smile.
"Hello, Mr. Pitts. How are you?"
Pitts replied that he was fine, and the president handed him his blue-gray suit jacket for the barber to hang up. Then he settled in the chair.
"The same as usual," Nixon said. "I hope you're not too upset over all the news."
Pitts wasn't sure what the president was referring to, but he assumed it was to the tape.
"No, sir," he said.
"Well,"
the president said, "we've made some mistakes, and we've done a lot of things right, too, and I'd like to thank you for your good service over the years."
Pitts thought that meant for sure that it was over. As Pitts finished, Nixon told him he was going on television that night.
"But I'll see you again," he said. "I'll probably come over to your shop in the Carlton sometime and get a haircut from you. I'll call you for an appointment just like anyone else. I won't just drop in on you."
"Mr. President," Pitts said, "it's been a pleasure working for you, sir. I still have great confidence in you, and I think you've been a great president. If I can ever be of any service to you in the future, it will always be my pleasure."
"You're very kind," the president said, rising and putting his arms out for his jacket, which Pitts was holding.
Nixon buttoned the jacket and then held out his hand.
"Goodbye," he said,
and then turned toward the door. He held the doorknob for a moment and turned to Pitts.
"Say goodbye to Mrs. Pitts."
Pitts felt sad. The president had always remembered his wife, had sent her a letter after she had had a cancer operation, and had invited the Pittses to several White House receptions. Pitts stood there for a few moments,
and then readied the shop for his next customer, Henry Kissinger. The president's haircut had taken 22 minutes. At 10:42, Nixon was back in the Oval Office to receive Price for a quick review of the speech before Ford arrived. That morning, at a ceremony at Blair House just across Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House, the vice president had presented medals of honor to the families of 7 American servicemen killed in Vietnam. Ford had been applauded by the crowds on the street, and his presence had caused a traffic jam. When he returned to his office in the EOB, Hartman told him the president wanted to see him. It was just before 11 when the vice president walked across the private drive between the EOB and the White House. Haig greeted him in the hall, taking him aside. "We still don't know which way he's going." Haig made a back-and-forth motion with his hand. "He has wavered." Haig had already told Ford that he was going to be president. Now, he was taking a step backward. Straddling both sides with the man who was likely to be his commander-in-chief might not make Haig a prophet, but it would demonstrate that he prepared carefully for any contingency. When Bull escorted Ford into the Oval Office at 11:01, Nixon was seated at his desk. Except for his double pen set, the phone, a binder, and several blank writing tablets, the top was clean, its surface gleaming. Ford took the chair to the right. Atkins came in to record the scene. He clicked off several frames. The president, as usual, was looking down at the floor, hunched forward as he talked. Atkins interrupted. "Mr. President, this is such an important picture. I'm going to ask you to move a little closer and talk directly to the vice president." Nixon straightened up. Atkins took his picture. Then they were alone. Nixon talked slowly, demonstrating his control and calm.
"Jerry, you'll do a good job," the president said.
He offered him advice, especially in the area of foreign affairs. He praised Kissinger to the vice president and thanked Ford for his support. His tone was not apologetic. Both men knew that the only reason Ford was sitting across from the president now, listening to these words, was that Nixon had lifted him out of the comparative obscurity of the House. Ford had always been a loyal party man, and his relationship with Nixon had never been more personal than that. Both men had been in politics for decades, and both were accustomed to the formality that smooths over ups and downs, political shifts, changes of fortune. Both were used to falling back, in moments of potential embarrassment, on rhetoric. There was no talk of past mistakes, no attempt to express honest emotions. Instead, they expressed high hopes for the future. They shared a conservative philosophy, were products of the Cold War and the politics of post-World War II America. Hard-working lawyers from small towns who went to Congress in the late 1940s. Nixon explained the mechanics of the transition to Ford. It was required merely that the president write a letter of resignation to the Secretary of State. When Kissinger received the letter, Nixon would cease to be president. Then, Ford could take the oath of office. As Nixon and Ford talked, Haig told Jewan to take Pat McKee's car and pick up Jaworski at the Jefferson Hotel. A White House sedan called for Haig at the 17th Street entrance of the EOB. Haig arrived home a few minutes before Jaworski. Pat Haig, the daughter of one Army general and the wife of another, brought the two men coffee in the living room. Jaworski declined. He never drank coffee. Haig placed a teaspoon of sugar in his cup and lit a cigarette. "Alec, you have to understand that we're to have no understanding," Jaworski said. He wanted to close the door to a deal before Haig had a chance to open it. A moment passed before Haig spoke. "Well, the president is going to announce his resignation tonight," he said, and waited. Jaworski thought Haig seemed beat, but was showing little emotion. "It's a tragedy," the prosecutor said, but he was relieved that it would soon be over. Haig looked at him. "Leon," he said, "I'm very much worried about the president." Jaworski was silent. Haig alluded to the pressure on Nixon and how agonizing his decision to quit had been. Jaworski expressed sympathy. Also, Haig said, he had another item for Jaworski's immediate attention. Haldeman and Ehrlichman had requested pardons, and pardons would not be granted.
That was good, Jaworski indicated.
He was not concerned about the general matter of pardons as long as they were being turned down. Again, Haig tried to approach the question of Nixon's future. He mentioned Nixon's intense depression and suggested that, by resigning, the president was saving the country a great deal of anguish. Jaworski said nothing. If necessary, Haig said, the president would invoke his rights under the Fifth Amendment and refuse to testify at any trial or legal proceeding on the grounds that it might incriminate him. Jaworski changed the subject.
Do you think you'll stay on? He asked. I think I will, at least for a while, Haig said.
The meeting ended with some small talk. At noon, the signature machine in the correspondence section of the White House was shut down. There would be no more letters from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue signed Richard M. Nixon. The news spread rapidly through the White House. Ken Clawson went down to Ziegler's office. He had heard that Ziegler was going to make an announcement and seemed dazed when told that the president was going to speak that night. In the press room, the reporters began to mass around the podium. A briefing, this time by Ziegler, was rumored. The bright television lights were turned on and a stenographer appeared. It was 12:19.
He's probably going to announce the new ambassador to Iceland, someone said.
Those in the room broke into laughter, but it was cut off as Ziegler walked in and went to the microphone. He looked stricken. Ziegler's secretaries fell into a hush and listened over the voice box piped back to their offices. Ziegler was sweating, and his hands shook as he placed a sheaf of papers on the podium. His statement was being covered live by radio and television. I am aware of the intense interest of the American people and of you in this room concerning developments today and over the last few days. This has, of course, been a difficult time. His voice cracked. He tried to clear his throat, and his voice cracked again. The muscles in his cheek twitched. The President of the United States will meet various members of the bipartisan leadership of Congress here at the White House early this evening, he said, gaining his composure. Tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, the President of the United States will address the nation on radio and television from his Oval Office. With that, Ziegler walked quickly out. His secretaries went back to work. Ann Greer was trying to finish Ziegler's thank you notes from the Mideast and Russian trips. She went out to the press room to get a Pepsi and was stopped by CBS reporter Robert Pierpoint.
What are the chances of seeing Ron? He asked.
Not very good.
I have to ask this question, Pierpont said in an apologetic tone. Can you ask it for me? When Ron said the President of the United States, did he mean President Ford or President Nixon?
Ziegler had very deliberately said the President of the United States and had not used a name. Greer went back and saw Ziegler. He was now in his shirt sleeves.
Ron, Pierpoint's got this question.
President Nixon, he said, laughing and shaking his head.
Ziegler was in the process of selecting the members of the staff who would be going to San Clemente for the transition. He called Ann Greer to his office. How are you? He asked her. The question had taken on a special meaning. Staff members were asking each other how they were adjusting to the shock.
Oh, fine,
Greer responded. A little uncertainly. The president is going to San Clemente tomorrow, Ziegler said. Please don't say anything to anyone about this. I'm going out there with him, and Diane and Frank are going. Would you like to go? Ziegler was silent for a moment as she considered her reply. You don't have to go, he added. But his tone said he expected her to say yes.
I wouldn't want to be anywhere else, she finally answered. Of course I'll go.
Fine, Ziegler said. Talk to Diane and work it out. It will be for between 30 and 60 days. We'll be working on transition things. Greer turned to leave. Now remember,
Ziegler repeated. Don't say anything to anyone. The packing in Ziegler's office began. A couple of footlockers were brought in, and tennis balls, eye drops, Marlboro cigarettes, and a large brown jar of Tiltralax stomach medicine were thrown in with other things. Greer and Johnson stood at a window, looking at the crowd of several hundred people outside the gates. Ziegler strolled by and asked them what they were doing. We're looking at the people, Greer said.
What are they looking at? Ziegler asked.
He checked himself.
They're looking at us.
St. Clair called John Wilson.
Have you a paper for me?
St. Clair asked delicately. The last draft of Haldeman's suggestions on the pardons and two drafts of speeches were just going through the typewriter.
Have we got 2 hours?
Yes,
said St. Clair. Two separate drafts, one of which included pardons for draft evaders, were rushed over to St. Clair. After his meeting with Ford, the president went to his